Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are back on a kind of lovely, gray, chill Sunday morning here recording. You guys always get this a couple days after we record so that our beautiful producer Trey can work all his magic. What are we drinking this morning, ladies? Radha, I'm looking through the video here, and you are drinking something fabulous. Please share.
I am drinking a lovely champagne cocktail that, as Erin and Lauren saw, I pre-mixed the mixers for. So that when I came down, all I had to do was top up with a nice bottle of bubbly. That while I had limited time to prep on the substance, I was prepped on the chilling, the appropriate kinds of alcohol to drink.
And if that's not a great foreign policy lesson, I don't know what is. Thank you.
Priorities, ladies.
On the flip side, I went to grab a Coke out of my fridge and discovered that there were none cold. And for those of you who have ever lived with or worked with me, you know that that is a near apocalyptic event. And because I'm completely incapable of drinking warm Coke over ice because it's disgusting.
I'm the opposite. I only like my Coke at room temperature.
That's vile. Wow. Well, you will never be in charge of keeping the emergency Coke cold in the fridge.
That sounds right. I'm willing to cede that.
So I reverted to LaCroix because it's been a slow morning here. And even after two full batches of coffee, I'm still feeling sort of meh. So I didn't think that wine or beer or gin was going to help that situation.
Although hard to say.
Maybe.
I am doing my usual coffee with Frangelico, though with a lot more Frangelico than usual, apparently, as I'm tasting it a lot more. I'm also noticing I either am going a lot more gray or there's more white paint in my hair than wear out from painting yesterday. So
I'm totally ignoring the gray in favor of just like, God, I need a haircut. And I do not wish the economy to open in order to give me a haircut. I do wish that any of the hair trimming or scissoring things that I had ordered online would arrive. Just any one of them would be an improvement at this point. So
if there are any Marines that live near Erin and have their own hair trimming devices, I'm sure she'd be happy to
contactless drop off. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That'd be super. All right. Lauren, would you like to introduce our fabulous guest?
We are here today with the brilliant and talented Dr. John Kwok, the senior fellow and SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at Brookings. She has an incredibly well-timed book out last week called Becoming Kim Jong-un. And we are delighted to have her join us. She has a background of studying the Kim Jong-un regime intensely. And in the week where we were all wondering where on earth did KJU go, it's very nice to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with you guys. I too have been fangirling you guys from afar. So it's great to actually see you and to talk to you today.
Awesome. So we are going to start, as usual, with our bombshell questions. And I will start with the first one. What skill or talent do you wish you had?
I would really like to be able to cook. No matter how many times I read a recipe, I have to keep looking it up to get the right ingredients. And I'm not sure what that is. And maybe I'm thinking about something else. It's just something that ingredients and recipes just don't stick with me. And so that's been a huge problem for my entire life. So if, you know, I wish I could throw things together and just be able to have that memory of all these recipes that I, you know, I wish I had in my brain.
Next question, which is my favorite amongst these, what book do you wish that you could live inside forever?
So when you asked me that question, I thought to myself, there's so many books that I love, but they're so incredibly and intensely depressing, right? Pachinko I love, but I don't want to live in it. Isabel Allende I love, but I don't want to live in her stories.
Definitely not.
Mario Vargas Llosa, I love those stories, but I don't want to live in them. I think maybe it might be The Power Broker by Robert Caro. I'm a New Yorker, and I used to give historic walking tours in New York, and my degree is in U.S. history, so I love these. I could live in that book. I mean, of course, you can live in that book because it's 1,300 pages, but there are all these little nuggets about all these places that you know, and, you know, people are really coming alive because they're so familiar to you as part of New York history, how the Hamptons came to be and how the roads and expressways to Long Island came to be, how urban renewal created this this environment that we live in today. So, you know, I could live in that book just for all the nuggets about New York City history.
Well, that's a fantastic answer. I don't think we had a
that was a delightful answer.
Nonfiction answer to that. So that's very ingenious, actually. This question has been, what place would you like to visit before it's destroyed by climate change? But we would also accept any place you'd like to visit once COVID restrictions are lifted and you feel comfortable flying again.
Yeah. You know, for that, I'm going to say something that I would say a place that I've been to already. You know, I was never really into the cold, snowy places. But I had the opportunity in December to go to Alaska. And it was this amazing, amazing place with, you know, amazing people, amazing nature, amazing wildlife. And it was so completely different from what I'm used to in New York and in Washington, in the Washington, D.C. area, that that I would love to go back there for the culture, the history, the art. But, you know, when I was there, you know, people feel climate change intensely there. And they feel East Asia and Asia affairs intensely there. You know, villages are already being moved away from the shore. So I would like to go back and to experience Alaska, you know, one more time and try and get a deeper understanding of it.
I had not even thought of Alaska as a climate change possible destination, but like that, first of all, I've never been there. And second, I think you have sold me to try to, if I ever feel comfortable getting a plane again to.
Yeah, exactly.
Rada, do you want to ask the last question?
Yeah. What robot do you wish you had in your house?
This again goes back to the first question on cooking. Now that the kids are home, I am shocked at how much they eat.
They're like little continuous food machines.
I am constantly making meals, snacks, cleaning up after snacks, dishes, load the dishwasher, unload the dishwasher, make more snacks. You know, it's just, if there could be a robot for COVID, you know, just for COVID, it would be just to make snacks and clean up after snacks.
Oh, yeah.
Also, why are their hands so sticky even when they don't eat sticky things? It's like an amazing magic kid quality.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow. The money we can make if we could generate a snack building robot. Yeah. And actually, you know, but what we should probably all do is just buy vending machines, snack vending machines, and take off all the prices and give those to our children. And like, that's probably 80% of parenting at this point.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. So it already exists. The vending machine already exists. We just have to install one in our house.
Right. Exactly. So like I said at the beginning, we are so excited to have you on to talk about your book, Becoming Kim Jong-un. And as I was reading it, one of the things I really liked was your use of the analogy of the puzzle and how, as an intelligence analyst looking at a closed, very closed society and very private individual, you have all these puzzle pieces, but you have no idea what the actual puzzle itself is going to build into. And on top of that, the reference that I really liked was that Kim Jong-un is very capable and powerful in choosing which puzzle pieces he chooses to give the world. And so my question for you on that is, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about Kim Jong-un in the U.S. national security community?
Yeah, I love that puzzle analogy too, but the CIA also uses that analogy in that, you know, in their recruitment side. Last time I saw it was about how do you solve these national security puzzles? Mm-hmm. And in the past 3 weeks when Kim Jong-un was missing, I think it was the classic puzzle where you have North Korean defectors providing a piece. You have the Chinese providing, you know, Chinese Weibo providing a piece. You have the South Korean government providing a piece, the U.S. providing a few pieces, the Japanese press also providing a few pieces. And we don't even know if we're all playing the same game or if we're all looking at the same puzzle. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the past 3 weeks has been a really good encapsulation of how this is such a tricky puzzle. And you know what happened? Yesterday, Kim Jong-un showed up and that's the puzzle. That is the piece that we were looking for. To show us what the picture should look like. I wrote this book because it's such a puzzle. We get snippets, we get snapshots from various events whether Kim is missing or there's a missile test or there's, he's opening up a fertilizer plant or something else that we don't have a real full picture in a non-sensationalist way. And I think there is, you know, because North Korea, I think, and Kim Jong-un himself tend to be such clickbait that, the more sensational the better. But, you know, I really wanted to provide this fuller picture that he's not a caricature, that he's not just about missiles. He's not just about the missile puzzle or the human rights puzzle or the dictatorship puzzle, but that there is a person to be analyzed, and whether, you know, through history, culture, language, architecture, art, ideology, to provide this picture of Kim that is that doesn't reduce him to a cartoon, mm-hmm. or came out to be this giant that can't be stopped by the U.S. or anybody else.
How do we think, I mean, we talk about this puzzle, and I'm always kind of fascinated by what I used to call, you know, secrets versus mysteries, right? And so the intelligence agencies are typically most designed around secrets, you know, stealing other people's secrets, you know, somebody else's missile plans, somebody else's war plans, the, you know, negotiating strategy for trade negotiations. But it also strikes me, I mean, North Korea obviously has lots of secrets, but there's also a lot of mysteries. Like, it's not always clear to me that they know the answer to these questions that we have, you know, either. It's so close. Are there historical comparisons that you think are useful in terms of thinking about a closed society and a closed regime like we have in North Korea? Or is it really kind of its own nature and of its own making?
I think there is something. So, and you're right, Aaron, that even people inside don't know what's happening at the core of the regime. And that's by design. And that goes to the issue of the fact that I think North Korea is in many ways very unique in how successfully they've closed themselves off with respect to North Korea's relationship with the outside world, that they've seen through the various histories of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Chinese turning their backs on them by normalizing ties with South Korea, and even negotiations with the U.S. for various, you know, different presidents, you know, would get rid of previous policies, that they can't trust anybody but themselves. And so there, that goes to the withdrawal from the outside world. But even inside, there is such a structure of repression and fear and internalized censorship that even there, you're not going to see a lot of people. You're not going to see people talking openly about Kim or the leadership or criticizing them. I remember one, reading defector accounts are really fascinating to a human scale, which is that the indoctrination and the fear was so strong that this one defector said, "I was afraid to even think bad thoughts about the leader." And so you have to wonder, like, how oppressive a system is where you are worried about your thoughts and somebody reading your thoughts, you know, by just thinking this, that it might be manifest outwardly and therefore put you and yourself in danger. The other thing too, is that, you're not just worried about yourself, you're worried about your family. The regime has a practice of putting three generations of your family into prison camps or punishing them for various reasons. So it's not an individual punishment, but it's a generational punishment.
The other comparison I was wondering if you could make for us, first of all, I think it's remarkable to note that this is a now second generation, or I'm sorry, third generation transfer of power in a communist country, which usually is not like a typically seen in other communist regimes. But the differences between Kim Jong-un and how he's approaching his leadership, particularly as against his father, but also as against his grandfather, and how, I mean, do American analysts or other analysts, do they make incorrect assumptions based on the differences or the similarities between those three individuals and leading North Korea?
Yeah, that's, you know, I worry about this a lot, and I think about this a lot, is that people who have been experts who have been watching Kim Jong-il think a certain way, right? And that, you know, Kim Jong-il has always scuttled every negotiation. This is how he behaved, you know, provocations and then dialogue, provocations, dialogue, try to extract concessions. So that's been the model for Kim Jong-il. And when Kim Jong-un came to power, there was a lot of optimism that because he was educated in Switzerland, that he would become this reformer. He's not like his father, his grandfather. And my, you know, I remember saying to a group once that, you know, Kim Jong-un is like the bad boyfriend of a really good friend of yours, where he'll say, baby, I'm not really like my dad or my grandfather. I'm going to be different. And, but it's something that it's the hope that, that he's going to be different in that way. But what I've seen in the past 8 years now is that he's able to take the best parts and what he finds useful from his father and his grandfather, and has been able to adapt it. You know, in that he's what we've seen in the past 2 years is that he's been able to use diplomacy to try to gain some concessions, political or otherwise. He has adopted his grandfather's looks to try to generate that nostalgia for a time when things were good in North Korea. But he's also tried to move a little bit away from their shadow, which is, you know, he's really amplified the modernity of North Korea to make it seem like it's his. You know, he's trying to create his own brand. And I'll say that in a couple of ways, a couple of reasons that I think this. And one is that he's really stepped up the nuclear weapons program and the conventional missile training, conventional military training. He doesn't want to be this this weak North Korea. He wants to, you know, he has got the optimism that only privilege affords somebody in that position. He's really, you know, accelerated the weapons program. Two, he's tried to have this modern North Korea with the skyscrapers, the water parks, the riding clubs, the luxury high-end restaurants and department stores. And so, and that is a way of trying to craft a different narrative about North Korea, different from his father's. Third is his wife. I think the fact that he brings his wife to the floor is really interesting. His father and his grandfather did not, kept their personal lives away from prying eyes. And, you know, that was for various reasons. But I think it's really interesting that Kim Jong-un brought his wife to the floor so early on in his rule. I mean, there was she appeared with him at this concert where there was a montage of Disney characters. And that was considered back then, that was 2012, where people thought, outsiders thought, oh, this, you know, Disney characters on stage and he's at a concert with this woman. Of course he's modern. Of course he's going to be different. But what we've really seen is that she's become one of the tools for him to soften the edges of this leadership. But I think it's also for different reasons. And I think it points to his longer term thinking is he's saying to the public inside that this is the mother of my child. This is the succession line. So the consorts, whatever, the other marriages, you know, don't be, you know, trying to align yourself with these other side branches. This is the woman who's going to be the first lady. You know, her position has been very much elevated. She was there for all the diplomacy. She was there looking very, very glamorous. And that projects the image of this modern North Korea, a responsible dictator, a responsible nuclear weapons power. And I think that, you know, those are some of the things that that he's different from his his predecessors, and how he's trying to make his own and design his own brand.
Sort of riffing off that a little bit, as we look forward, I think there's certainly been a lot of talk on the ways the U.S. could do a better job of incentivizing or bringing him to the table, or sort of aligning to have a more productive, or at least moving in the direction of productive relationship. Do you feel like there are clues from our mystery or like strong indicators of where we're likely to be successful in trying to move him towards better or sort of greater alignment, or alternatively things that should really be avoided because they're likely to generate really bad sort of digging in and reversals?
There are no good options, and you have heard this before on North Korea, but we have to try diplomacy because that's the least bad option, and you know, that's the only way we can get anywhere. But, you know, diplomacy doesn't preclude trying to make sure that, the WMD transfers don't happen. North Korea, as you guys know, has a long history of proliferation, bad actors. Their human rights violations have been documented by the United Nations. We have 30-something thousand defectors who whose stories can attest to some of, you know, to this brutality. We have Otto Warmbier, who was, you know, who died as a result of being in North Korea. You know, I think we have to be mindful of these issues. So the sanctions and the pressure have to play a role to try to show Kim that he can't have it all, that we're not going to sit aside while there might be sensitive technology transfers. And I think there's a misconception that the sanctions are there just to punish him, but that they're there to keep us safe. They've been in the, you know, they've been around for, you know, over a decade. And these are to make sure that North Korea is not a driver of instability elsewhere. So sanctions and pressure have to come together. And, you know, it's since 2016, the U.S. has put more pressure on North Korea by cutting off, but with these sectoral sanctions that cut off revenue generation via coal, iron, fish, textiles. And, you know, those are designed to make the regime, to get the regime to make the decision to whether to, you know, which one do they want more, economic development, or do they want their nuclear weapons? The problem here, I think, that we have to grapple with is how do we make the pain great enough for Kim to feel it? So Kim Jong-un and his father and his grandfather had a high tolerance for other people's pain. A lot of the pain generated by their really bad agricultural choices and economic policies and for their weapons programs have really hurt the vast majority of the people. You know, I'd like to couple the sanctions and the pressure with some more positive things like information penetration to try to create an environment where the people who are thirsting for information inside create a situation where they are able to understand this alternative vision or realities to make the regime more accountable to their needs. I think we need to spend more time on the elite. The elite are making money from Kim regime, from his turning a blind eye to some of the market activities. And the sanctions on the sectoral front are, I think, could go a long way in getting the elite to say, wait, this really isn't working for us because we're not making that much money. That prevents the regime from vacuuming up through taxes, right, by de facto taxes, what they can get from these moneymakers. So I think that would be something, I think the pressure has to come on all sides because he fears his people as much as he fears the United States.
That's one of the things that I liked in the I think it was the closing chapter of your book. I have been on the path of thinking that denuclearization is not a terribly realistic goal for North Korea, but the way that you framed it in terms of making nuclear weapons be a source of instability and harm for Kim Jong-un and his regime rather than his source of stability and regime survival was very compellingly done in a kind of shift in the issue that I thought a lot of analysts aren't taking right now. So to ask a question that I think is on everyone's minds over the past couple of weeks, you probably don't know, obviously, where did Kim Jong-un go for the last few weeks as he disappeared? But I was wondering if you could put that in the context of when he disappears for periods of time, and this is not the first time, he seems to have no interest in correcting public or international perception about what's going on. And in some cases, it feels like he's exacerbating it just by being like, yep, I can disappear sometimes. What are you going to do? Can you just offer some more context in terms of what he may or may not be thinking or what's going on behind the scenes with these sort of disappearances?
Yeah, right, Lauren. So he disappears all the time for a week, 2 weeks. This time he disappeared for 3 weeks. And a question that I kept getting is why, if he's alive, why doesn't the regime say something that, you know, that would suggest that he's fine? And here, North Korea doesn't work off of our schedule with our questions. They don't care. What is a greater priority is for them to make sure that no one gets close enough to him and that they have the absolute control on information. What Kim showing up and pretending like everything was back to normal, that's the thing that they want to show to the outside world. Everything's fine. I don't need to explain anything because in this scenario, I think explaining it would highlight the absence more domestically and show that they're actually responsive to what the outside is saying. So I would just say that, you know, North Korea doesn't care if, you know, what we're saying. But if I were Kim, I would have been watching very closely for what the U.S. knows and what the South Koreans know, how they've reacted, and learning. And I would also keep my ears to the ground about who in the elite or who in the system was actually saying something bad or, you know, said something, it would say something against him while he, in his absence. But in the long, you know, when I'm looking at this reporting, people were, you know, defectors, people inside were afraid to say anything about his absence. They said, you know, they would say to reporters, don't ask me any questions. I'm not really paying attention. And again, that goes to show how dangerous it is for anybody to say anything on the inside about where he might be or even, you know, provide any opinions on that matter.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. As we said at the beginning, her new book is Becoming Kim Jong-un, available weirdly delayed on Amazon sometimes, but many of your local and independent bookstores will have it, and please give it a read as well. But like I said, thank you so much for joining us. This is incredibly educational, and I hope you are washing your hands and surviving with small children, as all of us are.
Thank you so much. You guys are fabulous.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, let's shift gears into keeping up foreign relations / we stuck everything in White House mayhem this week, because it just, I don't know, felt that way. This is often like a challenging coding. We need like a code book to figure out what category we're putting to stories in. But I think pretty much all of these things derive from some privilege, predilection, parochialism of the Trump administration. And so they all, I guess, properly get understood as White House mayhem. But this only matters to people like us. I don't think any of our listeners actually care about these categories. No. It is a subject of intense debate every week. You all should realize. So let us start with Afghanistan, our perennial This Is Still a Thing, our very first and ongoing This Is Still a Thing. There's a couple of things going on there. Who wants to chime in a little bit on Afghanistan?
Well, I'll start just to remind folks of context that a couple of months ago, the United States announced that all of its troops would leave Afghanistan over the next just a bit over a year if the Taliban agreed to fight terrorist groups, quote unquote, and met other conditions of the agreement. And that the U.S. also said that the Taliban would be pledging to halt attacks on Afghanistan security forces. But that part of the agreement is not public, so we don't know exactly what it says, which is interesting given what is going on right now in terms of what appears to be a significant increase in Taliban attacks on Afghanistan security forces.
And also an increase in Twitter discussions of such things. I guess the American spokesman and one of the Taliban spokesmen actually had kind of a back and forth on Twitter about some of this, and it does sort of hint at, Lauren, the secret annexes that you discussed, which may have called for an 80% reduction in violence. It measured how, that's such a great question for Afghanistan, Radha, a question near and dear to our hearts. But yes, it looks like there's been a quite significant spike in attacks from between the Taliban against Afghan forces, and now there's sort of a looming threat of American reprisals in some regard.
Well, what's fun about that is that, like, we know those to be true, that there's been an increase in the attacks and also an increase in American airstrikes, or it appears to be true. But these numbers have not been released.
I was going to say, you keep saying we know it to be true, but what we know to be true is that people are saying it to be true, right? Which is, like, not exactly the same thing. And it's just worth noting that this data on Taliban attacks isn't necessarily classified. And there is some discussion that it will be released in the future, though maybe not right now. And it's not clear what released in the future means. Like, are they just going to give us some, like, it was 307, we swear.
And you mean released by the Pentagon. We believe this data is being collected by American forces, U.S. troops, et cetera. I have lots of questions about that because there's a whole tree falls in the forest situation that we've grappled with for quite some time, but the Pentagon is not going to release that information. Is that what we're saying?
Correct.
That is what we're saying. They are saying that they're not releasing it because it may impact this, you know, sensitive negotiation dynamic that we have with the Taliban. And yet that appears to be already problematic to begin with. As I said on Twitter, it's quite a bit of magical thinking on the part of the Pentagon. Overall, I appreciate their attempts here, while also just being like, come on, guys.
I mean, and especially in the context of some of the sort of Afghanistan papers discussions we've had in the past and sort of the, let's say, liberal use of metrics and measurement in justifying campaign decisions, to have Esper saying the U.S. could nullify the agreement if the Taliban fail to live up to their obligations, saying the evidence for that is this increased attack, but we can't actually show anyone the data or how we collect it or anything to make credible sort of this discussion on what not living up to their obligations mean, what increased attacks mean, how that relates to anything else. It's a lot of sort of like, trust us, they're bad, be better. And you'll know they're better when we say they're better. So it's not a lot of verify in this trust but verify situation.
And meanwhile, there's been some developments on the actual Afghan side. Folks may remember, or may not, because it was very easy to miss in many ways, that there was a presidential election in Afghanistan last year. There was a disputed outcome to that election. Essentially, the international community, for the most part, has recognized Ashraf Ghani as the president, but his opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, has never really accepted that and continues to introduce himself as the president, which is kind of a baller move in a very interesting way. But they've had kind of extended negotiations. You know, they had basically had like a shared presidency, a co-presidency type arrangement before, and there have been kind of ongoing talks about how they should, you know, how they might move forward in some sort of power sharing agreement. So I guess Abdullah Abdullah has made a new proposal to Ghani that Abdullah would essentially be chair of the negotiations committee, because again, remember, this peace agreement, quote unquote, is between the U.S. and the Taliban. There is as yet no agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government. And so Abdullah Abdullah is suggesting that his person be in charge of that. It's not clear yet if Ghani's going to approve of that arrangement or not, but there is, you know, games within games, wheels within wheels still turning on all of this. And, you know, ultimately the driving piece forward will be, you know, how the Afghans respond to each of these different developments. But there's ongoing issues with their negotiating strategy and picking negotiators, much less presidential people. So, Afghanistan, the gift that keeps on giving.
I was like, so it'll still be a thing the next time we come back to it.
Yeah, awesome. Super. Speaking of things that are still a thing, have you guys heard about the JCPOA at all lately?
Did you know that we're still participants in the JCPOA?
Are we? Did we define participant anywhere? I mean,
no. No.
So, Lauren Arata, can you remind our fair listeners who maybe aren't, you know, following this in close detail, what the JCPOA is and why we care today, whether we're still technically a part of it or not?
Yeah, let me take a stab at reminding us about the Joint Comprehensive Arms Control deal we had.
Plan of action.
I'm just gonna, you know, yeah. So we had this deal with Iran. Seemed like a good idea at the time.
It was a good idea at the time. Let the record reflect.
Nuclear weapons. We were going to stop, you know, crushing their economy. We got all of the world's powers, Europe, Russia, the U.S. We all agreed. We had a plan. And then the Trump administration ripped it up and said that they were going to get a better deal, which we do not currently have. But after the U.S. reimposing sanctions and basically making it impossible for people to trade with Iran, Iran appears to have decided that no one's in the deal anymore and returned to their previous ways. And now the U.S. would like to impose some arms embargo sanctions on Iran for violating the deal that the U.S. failed to adhere to themselves.
Well, the arms embargo is supposed to expire at the end of this year, right? And so that's what brings us back into the news. I had to do some digging to figure that out because I was definitely not following that little plot line.
And just as a reminder, the arms embargo was actually imposed as like an effort to create this maximum pressure campaign on Iran to bring them to the table with the idea that like restricting access to these critical sort of missile components and arms related issues would be a certain negotiating point. It's also worth noting that Iran is not doing great right now. They don't have like tons of disposable income, in part because they are being totally thwacked with the coronavirus and experiencing a huge amount of infection.
And also oil prices are negative.
And also oil is worth literally nothing. In fact, if you have some space to store like some barrels of oil, you could really make some money. They will put it in your backyard. So just putting it out there for listeners. I don't think that's literally true, guys. So I think what that means is, like, in some ways, this is picking a fight that it's not clear is actually even really deeply relevant right now. It's not like Iran was rushing out to spend trillions of dollars on arms purchases. I'm not saying they wouldn't purchase arms. I'm just saying, like, right now, this might not be the closest alligator to the boat.
Well, what's really fun about this, though, is that...
Are you using that word right?
Yeah, really fun. So the United States isn't really a participant in the deal anymore. So they're trying to get...
In fact, has said repeatedly that it has left...
There's press releases saying that we are no longer a participant. However, so they are trying to get one of our European friends to be like, hey, we should not end the arms embargo. We should extend the arms embargo. And it's highly unlikely that France or Germany would say cool. It's obviously unlikely that Russia would say cool. It may be, maybe Boris Johnson would be like, I got shit to do and like, fine, okay, but also probably not, which would require the United States to pretend as though, actually, no, guys, hey, we're part of the deal. And therefore, we, as you know, one of the original ruling parties that came with the JCPOA, we're saying that somebody's not in compliance. Therefore, we need to reinstitute snapback sanctions and extend the arms embargo, which is, I believe, a definition of uncool at this stage.
And perhaps also a little rich. I mean, that's really sort of using the terms of the JCPOA to enforce, you know, as an enforcement mechanism when we ourselves have walked away from it. And in fact, are in violation ourselves, depending on exactly how you want to read it. I mean, this is just like the height of kind of Brian Hook-led Iran policy. Yeah. And it drives me crazy.
I mean, it is crazy. And I think Phil Gordon's piece in War on the Rocks was pretty good on this point, on the many ways in which it's crazy. For me, I think the part that is most concerning is, even as Iran has drifted away from the central agreement, it has maintained some key elements. And actually, the most important, which is like just verification. Like, we still have a sense of what they're doing because they're letting us know. And that's a strategic calculation on Iran's part, I suspect, to make sure we know how they're drifting so that if we want to course correct, they can also demonstrate that they're coming back into the fold. If we really, I think, fully and truly break the agreement and they decide to not have any verification procedures anymore, it's not just that they'll return to what they're doing. It's that we won't know the particular ways in which they're returning to what they're doing.
Also, it's a non-trivial task to get us and our European allies aligned on Iran policy to begin with. That was one of the real challenges around pursuing the JCPOA to begin with, because the previous sanctions regime was beginning to fray. It took a lot of diplomatic effort to get the sanctions associated with JCPOA into place and to maintain them. And so by picking this fight and sort of forcing our European allies to do something that they're not super comfortable with, and they're, of course, furious that we have walked away from the JCPOA in the way that we have, we're basically picking a fight with our allies, driving a further wedge between the U.S. and Europe, while doing rather little to actually reduce Iranian access to outside arms, etc., while also being like giant dill holes. So I'm not thrilled about this.
And making it clear that no one should ever make a deal with us again, like super duper clear. And just like one last tiny point, also making it clear why dollar denominated trade and banking systems are not necessarily aligned with everyone's economic interests in the medium run, which is just my pet concern about all of these things. Guys, we're going to start a trade war in the middle of a pandemic.
Like on purpose or by accident or just
a little column A, a little column B. Apparently what we decided is that since stocks were kind of ticking up, though for not great reasons, which is that a lot of the restrictions are being lifted, but we'll leave that for another day, that what the U.S. would do is threaten to reignite our trade war with China to hold them accountable for starting a global pandemic. Roughly, if I could just catch us up.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess I'd so missed all of that subtext. My only question is, are you kidding me?
So, and also, Radha, I think you should clarify that, you know, previously when we talked about trade war, we talked about like increasing tariffs and stuff like that. But I feel as though they have begun to explore various nuclear options that are like, hopefully not actually
ones.
On. Well, no.
Okay. Just checking.
Not literal nuclear options, but literal like cutting off trade and basically shutting down U.S. Well, I mean, it's not like I say this because the words were said out loud. It's not even clear to me what that means. Like, how would we recreate all of our like supply chains instantaneously to source them with nothing that comes through China? Are we allowed China to be a secondary? Like, I just don't know, guys.
I personally like the floated proposal that we're just going to not pay back any of our debt to Bank of to China. Because
well, that's
that would
just
work out
true.
Really well.
We just don't say it out loud. That's the nature of US debt and how it works. I mean,
right.
No, that's not true. We pay it back with future debt that we borrow from the same people.
Oh, right. My favorite.
That's totally different, Aaron.
It's like a totally different version of credit card roulette. It's amazing.
So just to be clear, like some of these proposals that were released in the news, they are clearly like totally insane and being released on purpose is totally insane in order to allow for a more modest trade war akin to the one that we've been experiencing over the past couple of years to be reignited. Because why not?
Right. And like, just as a reminder, so we had just started when last we talked in detail about China that wasn't coronavirus related, we were actually talking about the first phase of this trade deal and de-escalation, delay of the additional round of sanctions that had been negotiated with Washington and Beijing. This was in the early part of 2020.
In the before time.
So all of that was sort of paused in the context of coronavirus. And it's probably worth talking here about a lot of the information and misinformation about China's role in coronavirus, which I will say, like all Trump things, has this kernel of truth. Like China was not as truthful as it should have been. Their data was skewed. It continues to be skewed. They were not as cooperative with the global community as they should have been. And I think that there is a nugget there of like China feeling like it needed to protect its image and not seem like the source of a global disease pandemic, basically undermine the effort to get ahead of this early. That having been said, there's a lot of other crazy talk that's going on that doesn't seem to be associated with things that China actually did.
Kind of shift a bit over to a quick misinformation, disinformation conversation. Like there's a lot of allegations about Chinese actions in this and quite valid accusations against China, both in terms of their refusal to provide information, which is sort of a misinformation unto itself, but also their sort of active disinformation campaign, which included at first such allegations that the virus came from a U.S. Army lab to other like pretty adorable, quote unquote, little cartoons that they're putting out in terms of how the virus originated, how it's being spread and how to treat it. But they're not the only source of this. There's a lot of really good resources out right now on what is being termed by the World Health Organization as an infodemic, where we're dealing with not just deliberate disinformation, but from states, but also from, you know, basically medical charlatans who are trying to make money off of this, or people who are just frankly not that great at interpreting medical data and are drawing incorrect conclusions around the spread of the virus and what the most effective treatments are. What's been interesting to watch is to see how all tech platforms from Facebook to Twitter, Medium, and others have been responding to this, which is far harsher than they have to pretty much any other disinformation, misinformation campaign. And it will be interesting to see how they continue any of these actions once the kind of the immediate crisis has ceased in any way, because they've taken pretty draconian measures of shutting down politicians, media figures, and like pretty senior folks, as well as just like randos that are clearly paid bots of some kind.
And it's just worth noting that on the more positive side of that, a lot of sort of more traditional science and academic journals are making a lot of effort to do the translational work to turn much more academic and scientific findings into much more accessible information in an effort to basically have verified sources of truth of at least where some of the science and where some of the medical information is at. All of that having been said, we're still going to start a trade war with China, and we're going to do it in the middle of possibly the worst economic conditions that have existed since the Great Depression, with just truly tremendous rates of unemployment and actually even lower ratios, employment population ratios. That is, there are a lot of people who aren't even trying to look for work and wouldn't count as unemployed. The fraction of the U.S. population that is actively employed is actually shockingly low relative to its normal standards, let alone to recessions that we have experienced with, like in 2008, plus, you know, oil issues, you know, supply chain issues. So it's not clear that trade war is like really the best.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it goes well with a demand shock. Supply shock.
Supply shock.
I mean, it's just going to be amazing. I mean, we have literally no policy tools to deal with supply shocks. Like, we have really no idea how to resolve them other than, I guess, ending the trade war. So more to come. That'll be exciting. Rada, you had a few comments, much more traditional White House mayhem commentary around a new report from the Pentagon that we wanted to talk about.
Just last week, the Pentagon released its annual report on sexual assault in the military. So this is a report where it talks about the number of reports of sexual assault, which went up slightly last year, about 3%. Now, it's worth noting here that reports are like just really hard to interpret because we don't know if that's more people being willing to report, which is actually good, or more sexual assaults happening, which is clearly bad, or some combination thereof. But what was most interesting with the report is that they also do these unit climate surveys with it and traditionally have shown sort of additional numbers from these surveys. In the most recent report, they actually provided narratives of the experience that people were having both with sexual harassment and with sexual assault, sort of anonymized scenarios and situations, which I think really do a lot to sort of add the narrative texture to what we mean with sort of relatively dry terms like unwanted sexual harassment or unwanted sexual contact and sexual harassment. And I think, you know, in the context of some of this discussion and in the context of the more dry numbers and the climate reports really highlights just how far we have to go in terms of culture change and response change in the military. In particular, there were some examples of sexual assault victims being reassigned from their unit to get them away from their abuser, having career consequences for them, but nothing for abusers, discussion of sort of inappropriate jokes and harassment that are largely seen as below the line in terms of any disciplinary action or even reporting. So getting a sense for that culture and the culture of discussion in the Pentagon is extremely helpful, both in the Pentagon context and in this like larger context as we continue to grapple with questions of how do we interpret long-time allegations, short-term allegations, natures of harassment, like descriptions of harassment. And so it's actually worth a rather depressing but really worthwhile read to kind of go through the report and get a sense of what's going on in the military.
Very cheery. Let's do some palate cleansing with a little pop culture. Do we have some pop culture tidbits to share?
Guys, last night, so I'm not really a country music person. Let me start there.
No.
My husband is. And his family sent over this suggestion of the Grand Ole Opry is doing every week these concerts with like huge country stars. Last night was Garth and I've already forgotten his wife's name, but she's really famous too.
Trisha Yearwood?
Yeah, her. thanks.
Lauren's from Texas.
They're just like, it's like two, like frankly, incredible musicians playing just them on stage with their guitars, singing songs. That's it. That's like to a totally empty Grand Ole Opry with like discussion of Opry history, why they pick certain songs. And it's really worthwhile. It was like, it was good, pretty good music. Again, I'm not a huge country person, but even like if you're not a country person, these are incredible musicians just like singing songs with a guitar. Like it was pretty awesome. You get to hear some Opry history, their first experiences with it, influences. So I recommend it. Apparently, there are other country people. They did it. Luke Bryant. My husband was very excited to learn. For those of you who like country, this was the first time I've ever heard this name. So go forth. Grand Ole Opry.
I went on a bike ride yesterday and listened to one of the recent Ologies podcast episodes, which was on penguinology. And as my nieces will tell you, Tanta loves penguins. And so I was super thrilled to spend, you know, 45 plus minutes, you know, on my bike, but also to spend all of those minutes learning about penguins. And the guest scientist they have on is himself hilarious.
Oh, that sounds great.
Basically dishes on like which penguins he likes and which ones he doesn't and like how kind of annoyed he is at Morgan Freeman and the, you know, but how much he likes Happy Feet. I mean, I like nature things. I've been watching lots of the like nature shows on Netflix. There's a great episode with cheetahs, Rada, that just is fantastic. But I do love the penguins. And I, you know, that was a very like cheery 45, 60 minutes.
So a little confession, which is every time I hear penguins, what I think is that when I was pregnant with my second son, my older son thought that pregnant and penguin sounded the same. And to this day, he'll ask you like, mommy, one day you were a penguin and then we had baby Finn. And you're like, not quite, but like kind of like,
I want you to ask there. Benedict Cumberbatch that question so you can watch Benedict Cumberbatch mispronounce penguin like in a way that was just so hilarious. Lauren, do you have any pop culture cheer to share?
So this is not actually true, but I feel like the only pop culture I've consumed in the last week has been Power Rangers because it's what my son is watching. I don't pay enough attention to actually understand what's going on, but just enough attention to wonder that there are like 70 Power Rangers franchises and like how is this still going on? It's on Netflix if anyone wants to revisit their childhood. I've been reading a lot of like, I would say airport nonfiction in the last week, which is actually really well suited to this moment.
It is.
I read But What If We're Wrong by Chuck Klosterman, which is a book about looking at the present as though it is the distant past and like how would people as historians analyze our current time period. How would they think about like the top television shows and the top songs and other things like that? And it's a nice little light read. You can kind of skim through it if you wanted to. And I am also trying to get through The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis, which is basically about our present crises amongst civil servants and through a lot of different agencies, particularly the APA. People probably read the Atlantic piece that came out a few years ago. And that's about it. I feel like I should really be consuming more music, more musical pop culture than I am right now.
I watched the Sondheim tribute, which is on YouTube, and I can like watch YouTube on my television, which kind of blows my mind because I'm old. And that was quite good. And I've also been watching a bunch of the series Abstract on Netflix, which is, along with The World's Most Extraordinary Homes, both of which are kind of like great, like happy hour background viewing. Like you're coming down from work, but you're not quite ready to dig into whatever real trash you have, ready to watch. So it's sort of I don't have kids here, so I can watch whatever weird crap I want. And so I watch things about designers and houses we'll never be able to afford. But the scenery's pretty. And it's fairly mind soothing and not at all stressful because I do not like stressful television.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else, ladies? Fabulous. We will see everyone again in a couple of weeks. Bye.